رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي امري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي. One of the things that we see in Karbala is that Imam Hussein alayhi salam had a much more grand and a much larger vision than simply something that was relative to him or to the people of that time. If we look at from the other perspective, that what happens to the world or the Muslim Ummah if Imam Hussein does not revolt, if there is not this uprising, then it puts a little bit more into perspective how important that was, and that it was calculated as part of his vision. If it wasn't for Imam Hussein's insight and vision to plan for the very, very future of the whole Muslim Ummah, to know that today you would need that inspiration from him, to know that his movement was not simply to uprise against Yazid. Yazid represented tyranny and zulm and oppression in every sense of the word. So his uprising against that, his courage, his standing up against injustice, this was all part of the vision for what was necessary for Islam to be sustained and the message that we can get from it today. Without seeing that example of what it means to stand up against injustice, then maybe we wouldn't know or understand to the magnitude that's necessary what it means to stand up against wrong. But because that vision was there and Imam Hussein understood that my standing up against this tyrant and this zalim is going to help every people at every time until the end of time understand what it means to stand up against oppression, he had a long-term vision as well. When you look at, for example, the issue of Palestine, there is a reason, even though that clip was from several years ago, not much has changed. If anything, things are continuing to get worse. So when someone like a leader like Imam Khomeini, when he's commanding a revolution, an Islamic revolution which the whole world is benefiting from, and later on when he makes this an official day in Ramadan, the day of Quds, for example, if you look at the vision in what he was trying to do, you can appreciate this and the movement and the Islamic movement a little bit more. Have you ever thought why, out of all of the places and the Muslim regions and countries that are suffering or that have been suffering at the hands of various forms of oppression, if you look at how all of these, even many of them were existent during that time of the Islamic Revolution, yet there was not to take anything away from the importance, injustice is wrong wherever it may be, whenever it may be, but to look at the vision and why Imam Khomeini made Quds an international recognized day and not, for example, another place. Wasn't there suffering in Iraq and continues to be even till now? the problems that existed in so many other Muslim countries that even he would speak about. But why particular to this? There were problems in Pakistan, and that time they continue with their many target killings of Shia Muslims in particular. But why not all of these other places, and why focus on this one place? This in itself, I don't want to go into all of the reason and the wisdom behind his vision, but the point is that it was part of a vision. And there was something more to it that required things that even if people all at that time wouldn't understand, that every year more and more people begin to get it. It makes more sense. The problem is still there. It's escalating. It's transcending into something so much bigger than a fight between two people. This is not about conflict. This is so much bigger than that. This is becoming a route for all kinds of other evils to take place. So when you see that and realize and understand that, and that was part of his vision to try to put Muslims completely on one side against this evil on the other side, then this is something that has been maintained many, many years after this revolution. Now, had he not had a vision, if we look at that also in a different light, that Imam had just pointed out to, for example, one region or one area that doesn't suffer from the very obvious and open enemy of Islam and all of humanity, then maybe people all across the world would not get and understand how severe and intense and important it is. Maybe some of those problems are not as big as intense, relatively speaking. So the idea that Imam Khomeini had, the idea that we see in Karbala, is the idea of not just doing something for the moment, but planning for long term. This affects everybody. So the lesson that we want to apply today is this lesson of vision. We ourselves, have we ever thought, for myself, what vision do I have? Where do I need to take myself, my akhlaq, my character? Where do I want to get? What vision do I have for myself? What vision do I have for my relationships that I have with people? What vision do I have for my family? Where do I want to see my family at this junction in 5 or 10 or 20 years? And what vision do I have for my community? Where do I want to see my community at? Where do I want to see my group of friends at? Where do I want to see my other fellow youth at, fellow students at? Where do I want to see us at in the future? Because if we don't plan for tomorrow, then we're going to be in trouble. The future is promised for those people who plan for it. You can benefit if you plan for it. You don't get into your car and just start driving aimlessly. Eventually, inshallah, I'm going to end up somewhere because I'm going to run out of gas. You don't just go and just see, let's see what happened, where this is going to take me. Let's see what life has planned for me. You have to plan yourself. Yes, one of the ideas is that whatever Allah wants will happen, and I trust my affairs in Him. I'm content with whatever happens. I submit to whatever Allah ultimately wants. But it doesn't mean that I do not plan. One of the things that really affects our communities is lack of planning. And I want to give you this example from something that I grew up experiencing in many communities everywhere. They have this problem. obviously, one of the most important things, if you're planning for the future of the community, then you have to plan for the future, which is the younger generation. It just is very clear and obvious. I'm planning for where the community is going to be in 10 or 20 years, and I need to think about those children who are not even born yet, who are part of, who will be part of the community, the children who are here, the older children. Where are all these people going to be, and what role will they play in this community? If I plan for that and what they can offer, then I can prepare them accordingly. The youth in Karbala were prepared to be brave, courageous, and to defend their imam at all costs. They were groomed, they were educated, and they were taught that way. So when the opportunity presented itself, they were not afraid, or they were not even hesitant. One of the things that Imam Hussein mentions on his journey, he asks, after the news reaches them while they're still on their way, the news reaches them that Muslim ibn Aqil has been killed. So he asks the sons of Muslim, do you want to continue on this journey? What do you think about the situation? It was very common that even though they were in, the imams were in positions of leadership, they would ask people to share their thoughts. They would take into consideration their views. And he asked them, what do they think about the situation now that their father has been martyred, has become shaheed? Do they want to turn back? Would they rather not go? And they were very adamant about continuing the journey. They said, what will people say? We want to be those people who halfway went with Imam Hussein. We don't want to be known as those people who did not thrust spears and fight alongside and defend their imam. We want to go all the way. So they were prepared. So even in this difficult moment where someone's bringing you the news of your father's death, you're persistent in knowing that you want to be on the right side of things. It's not an easy thing to do. Maybe it sounds easy because we see examples of it, but this is the epitome of bravery. It's not a very simple thing to accept. But the point is that they were prepared. They had been made aware. They were being educated from young ages. And this information and the knowledge that they needed was being instilled in them. And so then they were prepared when that moment came to make the right choice. A lot of times you find in communities that there is not necessarily that same presence when it comes to youth, or there are certain things that are missing, certain ingredients, certain programs maybe, or even sometimes the programs are there, the participation is not there. A lot of different things that revolve around this. So there's a couple of very important points. Obviously, the first was the preparation. And what that actually entails is that there has to be some investment. If I want to take advantage of this opportunity, then I have to invest in it. Just like when we see an opportunity to maybe buy property or an opportunity to learn something, we try to take advantage of that opportunity. We say, well, even if I'm not going to use it at this very moment, I look at it as an investment, that I'm investing in this, or I'm investing in myself by learning, for example, with education. That if I learn these things, then it's going to be benefiting me later. This one Hollywood director, he was talking about how all of the things that he was specializing in, a lot of different techniques that they use for special effects and things of this nature. And he was saying that all of the things that I ever studied about physics and math, it never made sense to me until now when I'm trying to apply them. But I was investing in myself by learning all of the tools that I needed. And then I saw, as I began to learn how to use them more and apply them, what role all of these different types of math and physics and things like that, what role they played. So we have to invest in the future of our communities if we expect them to be able to be successful. Now, something that happens is that sometimes people, they don't invest, and then they find themselves at a crossroads and they're trying to struggle with repairing something that they didn't plan for. And it makes it just that much more difficult. I remember that at the time that I was growing up, and there weren't really English programs around, and we would go to the next closest center in another state and to experience some kind of program for Imam Hussein. When we would travel to these different places, sometimes that city, maybe a different state, but we would go to wherever there was a program, even if that program was not being held in English, because at that time there weren't really that many English programs. It wasn't part of the goal or vision for a lot of communities that they know that there would be a need for that. So they didn't really plan for that. So over the course of time, you find that these same centers or some masajid, they get to a point where they realize that, yes, we're having programs, for example, in Farsi, or we're having programs in Arabic or Urdu, but now our children are being brought up here and their first language is English. Maybe their second language is, you know, one of these languages. Maybe it's not even their second language so much so. So that was one part that changed the structure of things. That now suddenly there's a whole group of people who are not getting that same benefit that the older generation is able to get. That same passion and love of the Ahlul Bayt that's necessary, that same right thinking that they're being able to get by scholars and so on and so forth, it's missing for this next generation, and they were slightly disconnected. Maybe they understood the language, they didn't understand it as well. Or a lot of times with, especially like in Urdu and Farsi, or Arabic even, the language of the member sometimes is a little bit more difficult than the average language that people use when they talk to each other. You know, I can say two words of Urdu, Kayahala, Acha, you know. So those are not going to get you by if you're listening to, you know, a very eloquent, good speaker. You might not get everything that message in the way that it was intended. You may not be able to benefit from it. So the idea was, part of that was that problem. The other issue is that there is a huge wave in an influx of Shia Muslim converts who are growing up here. They learn about Islam, they learn about Shia Islam like we were, or like my family was, and they want to go to some center. So now there are other people whose only medium of communication is English, and they want to connect with some kind of program. So you have these different things that a lot of times when centers were created, this was not part of the plan. This was not part of the vision that this would be a need to be established. So that does play its role in a lot of things. We have to definitely invest in our youth. A lot of times you find some centers that they're missing, for example, a particular age bracket. That this particular age bracket doesn't really come to the center. And a lot of times this is a result of that lack of planning that occurred for so long, that the needs weren't being met for so long, so then this age bracket doesn't feel the need to be present anymore. So if we're not planning for the vision of whatever that may be, whatever that may entail, if there's, for example, if you live in a place where the majority of people, like let's say in an area like in Texas or maybe in some parts of California, where there's such a high number now of convert Spanish-speaking Muslims, if there's not a vision to plan for something for these Muslims, or many of them Shia, then there's going to be an area that's void and it's missing, that we did not serve the needs that the community had. So if this is part of the vision, and I realize that this is a growing number, and I live in that area, then I have to plan for that accordingly. That, okay, slowly, slowly, we need to make sure we have some books on the shelf, for example, that are in Spanish. Somebody comes by and they want to know, then, hey, everybody learn two words of Spanish at least, not just hasta la vista, baby. Learn how to say something else as well, in case someone comes to the church. A little bit more, educate yourself. Be prepared. How that has to be part of the overall vision for where you're trying to go as a community. Now let's talk about this, the youth, and let's talk about what it means to invest in them, because the young person who's not trained and not educated becomes an older, uneducated, untrained person. Imam Ali alayhi salam, there's a hadith from him. He says, إِذَا شَابَ الْعَقِلْ شَبَّ عَقْلُهُ, that if a intelligent person, when he gets older, his aql and his intellect, it gets more sharp. He learns more. He's educated. He's understanding. You find somebody that is a smart person, an educated person, that they've taken the time to instill these whatever knowledge, that they have no problem learning about new concepts, new things, and exploring and more knowledge, or becoming better. If they have some basis of good character and things like that, then it's easy for them to mature and to continue to have that. But the opposite is that شَابَ الْجَاهِلُ شَابَ الْجَاهِلُ, that if this ignorant person, if it's a young person and he doesn't know any better, he's bad manners, he's in majlis picking on his nose, he's just doing all kinds of things that are inappropriate, and then he grows up, he's going to be that same, he's going to be the old guy in the majlis picking his nose. It's not going to be any different because he never was trained. The ignorance remained with him from the time that he was younger to the time that he became older. So the idea is that you put the right thinking from the young age, then it transcends and it continues with this person as they get older. In another hadith from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam,
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
He says, "Man ta'allama fi shababih kana bi manzilati ar-rasm fil hajar." The person who learns while they are young, man ta'allama, while they're in their youth, it is in the same place, bimanzilati ras, engraving on a stone. That when you teach someone at a young age, it is like you have engraved this into their brain. And they have such Allah gave their intellectual or mental capacity such that they will retain that forever, for a long time. It just remains with them. But it says, وَمَنْ تَعَلَّمَ وَهُوَ كَبِيرٌ, when someone is trying to learn and they're older, sometimes it's more difficult, it says, كَانَ بِمَنْزِلَةِ الْكِتَابِ عَلَى وَجْهِ الْمَا, it's like writing on the surface of water. And it doesn't stay, it doesn't stick the same way that it does for a lot of times for people who are younger. So that investment has to be made in for them. A lot of times people, when they ask me, for example, about why I speak Farsi very well, or I speak without an accent, I can speak like average Iranian. And if that is the case, then it is only because of two reasons. One is the blessings of Hazrat Ma'asuma, then Qom, that she had put so much blessing in my life. And the other is that I was at a very young age when I was exposed to this language, and learning it seemed seamless or very easy. Did not even realize how quickly I was learning or able to communicate and on what level. So this is something that can happen very naturally if we invest in our youth. The way that Imam Hassan alayhi salam,
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad,
the way that he explains it, he says that the heart, he's narrating actually from Imam Ali, I believe it's in Nahjul Balagha, but he mentions that the heart of a young person is like an open field. You can take this open field, you can go plant trees in it, you can go plant roses, you can have vegetation, it can be fruitful, or you can make it a dump and throw all your garbage in it. Whatever you put in it is going to receive that, is going to take that. So if you invest in it and you put good things into it, then it's going to be that much beneficial. But it's going to take whatever it receives. This is why you see all of the effects that, especially for younger people, that video games, cartoons, things like that, television, how much work they put into marketing these things, because if they want to get an idea across and they put it in this way, it's going to be set in their minds. It's going to affect them a lot. So sometimes you find like they do studies with a lot of youth who are desensitized when it comes to things like violence, for example. And they don't really think about how the consequences of violent actions and what really happens. You know, and maybe, and this is a lot of times they say effect of, for example, some of the video games where you're shooting people up, blah, 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 you're killing them, and the next thing you know, they pop back up, right? So you don't get the idea and the concept that people, when they get shot like that, they don't really get back up. They don't have 10 more lives in a special place where they can go find new lives in some secret code. These type of things don't exist. But the perception, when that's implanted into someone's head, sometimes they actually have a problem letting go with that reality and understanding these real, very, very real concepts. So if we implant the right things, if we give our youth the right education, we teach them the right things, the right manners, and all of these things, then we can expect that, inshallah, they'll be more prepared for the next stage. And that next stage is that they have to be given responsibility. Part of the vision in changing, where having this type of vision where the youth are invested in, at some point it has to be such that the responsibility transcends, or goes from the elders to the younger generation. Slowly this gap has to be closed and the responsibility has to transfer. What happens a lot of times is that the responsibility never transfers and the youth never learn how to be responsible. They never learn or they never experience what it means to be in a position where you're responsible. One of the things I remember that there's a friend of mine who was in the Hosen, and he had a teacher that he really, really liked. He would always go to class, at this teacher's class, but he would always be late, all the time. It was his favorite class and favorite teacher, but he had the, you know, problem that many of us suffer from, and we can't do things on time. So he was going to class and always coming late all the time, few minutes late. And so the teacher noticed this problem. So he found a way that he was going to deal with this problem by giving this youth some responsibility to help him help to mold his character. He said, "We need somebody to be in charge of the markers and the erasers. So, brother so-and-so, you're going to be in charge of these markers. I need them to be here at the very start of class." And he took this responsibility, albeit so small, very seriously. It was the starting point for him that he began to come to class on time. He had something to accomplish. He had something to prove. He He was on a mission every day before class, that I have to get this there because this is being asked of me. Now I'm not just some participant in a class. Now I am a person who has a role and of even though limited authority, and I need to participate because of that. So this made him and encouraged him to be to be more prompt when attending class. One of the things that we see in Islamic etiquette when it comes to raising children, for example, that you have probably heard the hadith that mentions about the different cycles of seven, how the first 7 years the child is treated like the king, right? Until they're seven, the first 7 years, they're able to do whatever they want. There's not consequences. You let them kind of be. Do what they want. They want to play around. They want to do things to you. Don't restrict them too much. You give them a lot of freedom to be in charge. You don't try to put too much restrictions and discipline on them for things. Doesn't mean like you let them do anything. You're not going to let a two-year-old play with knives. You're the king now. You do what you want with those knives. You don't go to that extreme, but you give them freedom to do things. And then the training begins. And it says the next 7 years, they're the abd, they're the servant. And you teach them and you train them. This is how you treat someone. This is the things that you do. This is the way that you treat, guests. This is the way that you do this. This is how you wash dishes. This is how you do that. You begin to train them in different things so that they gain these good habits while they're very open and able to learn these things and make them a part of them. You teach them good training, good home training, good manners, good adab, all of these things. Then they go as they get a little bit older and they become a teenager, and it says that it talks about that next set of seven. How now they're at a phase where you've done, where all the training that's supposed to take place has taken place. Not all, but a very important part of the training has taken place. Now there's a different relationship that exists between the parents and the child, in the sense that now this person, they're considered the vizier. So the role of the vizier, the minister, is that they have some responsibility. They're not the president, they don't have the full control and responsibility, but they're giving some authority, some responsibility, and they're also held accountable for that. Okay, this is your area. You take care of this, and you decide about this. They consult with the vizier. Sometimes the president may come and say, well, what do you think about this situation? What if we do this way? What do you think about if we go here? What do you think? Do you think this is a nice idea? Or this? And you get the input from the vizier. And now this person feels validated because they are a deciding member. They have a very important role in this, family. And this gives them, and by giving them the responsibility, you're able to train them for being that, you're investing in them more. Now they're able to take on that responsibility. After a while, they're able to do that with ease. They can do that very well. And now the responsibilities transfer over to these older youth. So what has to happen is that at some point the investment has to start where these younger children are given responsibilities and they're given opportunities to prove yourself. Sometimes people say, well, the youth, they don't come forward, they don't come forward and say that they want to be in charge and they want to have this responsibility and they want to do this. I can probably name on one broken hand how many youth automatically think that about these things, that I need to take on a responsibility. It may not necessarily come that naturally, but the guidance that you can take on this or encouraging them to do that, that makes a big difference. So if someone encourages a young person, says, hey, you know what, you're really good at this, you're very talented, I'd like to see you do this, today or the next day or different things like that, then you see that their potentials are being, they're reaching them. they're achieving something because now they've been encouraged to take on this responsibility. Sometimes, a lot of time as youth, leadership is not something that comes always natural for everybody. People have to be groomed to be leaders. Sometimes people can have good qualifications but not necessarily be leaders. If you want someone to be able to take on leadership, then they have to be groomed to take on leadership. They have to be told, okay, this is what you do when there's other people not doing something right. You still stand for what's right. You don't just sit back when you see wrong. You have to try to say this to your friends. And you give them opportunities and responsibility to do these type of things. By having that responsibility, eventually, inshallah, they're able to take on the role of being very important and influential in the different centers. We can see a lot of examples in history where the people were young who were the leaders and who were teachers. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. He said he likes to see young people either learning or teaching. One of the two. Busying their time with learning or teaching. Learn something, teach it to someone, continue to learn, to busy your time with it. He says, when you're not doing this, then it means you're wasting time. Wasting time, it means that Shaitan is going to come looking for you. Oh, you don't have anything to do? I have something we can do. And he comes looking for you. This is how people start to commit sin or get into other, you know, trouble. So, busying their time, using it properly, doing something positive with that. I've seen an example of this in one center where the youth were not just, you know, like for example, a lot of centers they have like a youth group or something like that. But the youth were not just a group of people. They were actually the program director, the person who was responsible for calling the alim for any program. He had that responsibility. And by giving this responsibility to the youth, what happened was this person became groomed. The first time they made one mistake, they forgot something, they lost a number, they made some errors, but they learned how to do this. And what happened now, this person can do that very well. And he can train this other youth to be able to fill this type of position. And what that does in a community setting, it allows for elders to not have to have so much burden on their shoulders. Because usually it's the elders that are supporting the center, at least financially. So they're supporting the center financially. They all have full-time jobs. In addition to this, now they have a second full-time job where they're doing this volunteer work and that volunteer work, and it makes it very burdensome. And even if people do it because they love the Ahlul Bayt and things like that, it doesn't mean that it's not a burden. It doesn't mean that, in the last, sometimes it takes away from their family time, it takes away from all kinds of other things. But if people who have more time, usually or typically, are stepping up into that void and are doing it successfully with some guidance, you know, then that allows for a good transition and it allows for the centers to be alive, to be very engaging, that they're someone who has more time, because a lot of times, for example, someone whose job is the person who's in charge of the programming, sometimes that they don't get a chance to do certain things that are new things, for example. But maybe somebody who is fresh and has new ideas and new time and more time, he can go and look and say, hey, this is a program that they do here. He'll go spend more time researching online, comparing different programs, comparing speakers, always being up to date on new speakers that are around, who's talking about what, and different ideas. Sometimes all of that extra stuff is too much extra. If they're doing it, they're trying to do it in the normal capacity of what's necessary to be done. So there's a need for this to happen. And for communities to be successful, they have to invest and transfer responsibilities. This is something that's very critical. And you don't plan for the future, you will suffer eventually. Every place that does not plan, doesn't have a vision for their future, they're going to suffer like that. Listen to Allah Ta'ala. So one of the things that has also happened throughout the course of time, at least I'm talking about communities and Shia communities, specifically in America. One of the other things that has happened is that the need was eventually realized that there has to be more English programs, or there has to be more activities and or more scholars coming that are speaking English. So this need has been realized probably everywhere, or nearly every center they have, you know, some kind of English program. Almost. There's still places that don't. But for the most part, this is something that a lot of places are realizing. One of the things that I feel from my experience in dealing with a lot of different communities, one of the things that I feel is a very, very strategic error that I see over and over again is that the English programs are called the youth programs, and they become this one amalgamated mess. So what that literally means is that because there's a realization that a lot of the youth require English programs, it doesn't necessarily mean that that there doesn't need to be the same level. I'll give you an example of programming in English as it is in other languages. For example, I hear this feedback often that a lot of speakers, when they come to the English program, their delivery, or not necessarily delivery, but the content is on a low level. Or I've heard all of this before, or something of this nature. Or I feel like I'm not being intellectually challenged. I feel like I'm not being, you know, I'm not learning as much. I feel like it's not as stimulating. So one of the things that you have to take into consideration, me as a speaker, I can share with you that one of the very, very critical things about speaking to people is you have to speak in the language of the listener. It's just bottom line. It's one of the fundamental laws in psychology. You have to speak in the language of the listener. Nobody sits down with a group of five-year-olds and begins to tell them about metaphysics and things of that nature. They're going to be looking at you like, do you have a coloring book to go along with this speech? You have to talk in their language and in a way that is going to be understandable for them. And the same thing goes for someone who's, you know, if someone's an academic, then they have a different language. If someone is, you know, different backgrounds, they may have different languages. These things have to be taken into consideration. It's very, very important because each person cannot be spoken to the same. If we look at our imams, one of the things that was beautiful about the ahadith that we have, and actually simultaneously, it for some purposes, some people have caused it to become a type of source of fitna, but I'll explain that. But one of the things that the imams do, or would do, is that when someone would come and ask them a question, they would give them the answer in proportion to their capacity. So somebody comes and they have no understanding about this concept, the imam is not going to go into great detail, whereas he knows that it's not going to benefit him. In fact, it's going to make him more confused. But the more the capacity that that person has, they're able to understand more, they're on a very high level, they're a high level student of the imam, for example, when he asks him a question, he gives him an answer that he's satisfied, that it expands his capacity of thinking. So we have, for example, somebody like Salman al-Farsi, who was a very high level student. And the hadith mentions that if Abu Dhar knew what was in the heart of Salman, that he would want to kill him. Not out of jealousy or something like that, but out of the idea that Abu Dhar was going to stand on the right, and if he saw someone who had an idea or thought something which he didn't understand or wasn't in his capacity necessarily, then he would want to challenge that to that extent. So there are some things that are proportionate to some individuals. And that person, they can benefit from that. Another person is not going to benefit from that. Sometimes even people, now when I say use this as a source of fitna, they may take a hadith that was given in proportion to a particular companion and try to use that as an exclusive source for all, apply it to every scenario, when that's not necessarily the case. And sometimes it's other things, or there are certain circumstances where something was said in a particular circumstance, but that circumstance was unique, and it's not always the case. So we can't take things out of context, basically, is what I'm saying. But nonetheless, there is this idea that they would talk and give in the capacity of what that person was able to understand. So you have some very long hadith about understanding the concept, for example, of the existence of God, the concept of creation, the concept of the universe, some concept that people get very confused about. Then you have some hadith that are just a few lines that are answering somebody about the very same thing from the same imam. So you have to understand that there's a place for each thing. Maybe that wasn't the place for that. Maybe that wasn't the person who's able to benefit from that knowledge. So when a speaker has to come and give and deliver a lecture, it becomes a challenge if English and youth program are always synonymous. And that means that there's a wide range often of people who are in this program. The solution and the need is that the same level or the same way that there is, for example, an Urdu program or Farsi program, there has to be an English program. A youth program has to also be available. Youth program has to be something that it revolves around or includes activities during Muharram. That's something that's for, you know, a younger person that's going to be more appropriate. How to, very, very practically, something that applies to them. A very, very young person. They need a coloring book about Karbala. They need to do some activities. If it's about Hajj, they need to make a model Kaaba or something like that. They need to make a poster board. Different things that are entertaining and give the same message, because that's the goal, is to give the message of Imam Hussein, not just to see how can we duplicate majalis. We want to be effective in conveying the message, if it's in the form of a speech, if it's the form of activity, a workshop, whatever that may be. So for that other crowd, they are able to be able to appreciate more, be more intellectually stimulated, and for obvious reasons. So this problem is one of the things that hasn't been realized a lot of places, that there is a need. On top of that, there's another problem. That is that even if I myself am going as a participant to a program, and you tell me, well, there's a youth program here. I don't know what that means, youth. And that might be 10-year-olds. It might be 25-year-olds. So I might not go to that program, because the word youth is on it. I don't know if that means that it's, you know, age appropriate for me. So there was even a similar situation. We had a program that was done by organization. They did a program. It was called this youth program, this youth event. Because it was called the youth, and it wasn't intended to be only for youth, but because that name was on, it was intended to be for English-speaking people. But I saw a lot of English-speaking people that I asked them, well, how was that program? I said, I didn't go. I'm 45 years old. Why would I go to that? It said youth program. So this is just an idea that it alienates a lot of people without meaning to. The intention is that we want to provide something in English, but the reality is that for people who may be considered youth, relatively speaking, in the community, if they're older or college age or above that, then they might not necessarily consider themselves to be, you know, youth or want to participate in those kind of programs, or any other people, converts, and so on and so forth. So it creates an actual, you know, misconception sometimes. If somebody were to be new to the community, and for example, they didn't know about the program that we're having tonight, they just came here a few days ago and they clicked on, let's say like there was a website, they clicked on a program that said that there's a youth program. They may feel that, well, I'm not going to go to a youth program. Oh, the adult program is in English, so the youth program is for kids, is in the adult program is in order, the youth program is in. If that becomes the perception, you know, not saying that it is, but if that becomes a perception, then it obviously makes it, it alienates a lot of people. The point of this whole discussion is we're talking about having a vision for our communities, a vision for ourselves. And one of the only ways to achieve this vision is to invest in our communities, to invest in ourselves. We have to have very strategic plans for doing that. We can't just leave it up to chance that, you know, inshallah, as long as there's something called youth program, people are going to come. It has to be so much more proactive, so much more has to go into it than that. It can't be any less than any other program. If anything, it has to be the priority if we believe that this is the future, and inshallah, the soldiers of the Mahdi, ajalallahu farajahum al-sharif. There are some other points that I want to make about the importance and the role of youth, especially because it's so relevant in Karbala, that so many of these youth, they were prepared, they were brave, they were ready to give anything for the cause of Islam, and that is ideally what we need to be striving for, what are the children of our communities need to be exactly like. There's a model example. So let's talk about one of those model examples in Qasim ibn al-Hassan. Hazrat Qasim was alongside and sitting with all of the other companions of Imam Hussein. When the companions of Imam Hussein sat and they heard what Imam Hussein was saying in his speech and telling them that, do you really want to stay with me? Do you realize that, you know, we're facing some difficulty, that we're in a very tough spot, that if you would like to go and leave, he gave them that option. He told them they were the best of companions for coming that far. He said, the night is dark. Use the night as a cloak and go away in the night. You know, if you don't want anyone to know that you were ashamed to go to battle, then you don't have to go. Just walk away and just leave. Go with, be with your families. And these best of companions who remained there, when it all came down to it, none of them were willing. They said, Wallah, we're standing by you to the very end. He said, since all of you have agreed to be here, then I have to tell you some news. They said, what is the news, Abu Abdullah? Imam Hussein told them that the news is that we're all going to be killed. That is the news that I have to tell you. Do you know the response of the companions of Imam Hussein? They said, Alhamdulillah, Shukrullah. This is a great honor for us. Praise be to Allah. You've given us the greatest honor to be killed, to be killed and fighting and defending you, O Abu Abdullah. So they were happy that they were about to become the greatest shuhada ever to live. One person from the corner was sitting, a young frail child. His name was Qasim, the son of Imam Hassan. He heard the words of his uncle, and he wasn't sure. He said, we're all going to die. Did he mean that he was talking about me? So he was asking Imam Hussein, he said, Ya Amma, oh my uncle, when you're saying all of us, are you talking about me too? Am I going to also have that honor of shahada? Am I going to also have that honor to become a shaheed for you? And Imam Hussein said, before I answer your question, let me ask you a question. He says, what do you think about maut? What do you think about death, Ya Qasim? What do you think about that? And he says, that it's sweeter to me than honey. Ahla min asal. That this is sweeter to me than honey itself. That I would love to taste the sweetness of shahadat and martyrdom and defending you, my uncle. So in that case, he said, yes, you will become one of these shahada. And the time that it came, that everyone who wanted to go to the battlefield, they had to get permission and izn from Imam Hussein alayhi salam. It came a time when there was few people left, many had already passed away. It says Ali Akbar had already become shaheed, and Qasim comes and he says, Ya Amma, Oh, my uncle, will you let me please go? Please give me permission to go and fight for you. Please give me the permission to go and defend you. It says that Imam Hussein didn't want to give him permission, but he wanted to give him permission at the same time. He was very torn about this situation. Also said, please, my father, and he began, please, my uncle, he began to hug Imam Hussein and cry, and he kissed the hands of Imam Hussein. Please let me go. Please let me fight for you. He was begging to taste the honey of Shahada. And finally, Imam Hussein, he couldn't even bring himself to say that I give you permission. He just was able to bring Qasim close to him, hug him, and cry with him, and say, now I bid you khuda hafiz. Now I bid you goodbye, my dear nephew. And Qasim went to the battlefield, and it says that he was so small and young, that he couldn't wear the helmets that all the other soldiers who were grown and adults were wearing. That he just had on an imama and he wrapped it, and he went to the battlefield wearing this heavy armor and this heavy sword. And he went to fight against the enemies, and it says so many enemies surrounded him. They said, who is this person? Who is this young person coming to fight? And then he announced himself, I'm the son of Hassan, the son of Ali ibn Abi Talib. And he goes to the battlefield. I am the nephew of Imam Hussein that you are fighting. Know who I am when he goes to the battlefield, he says. And after he fights, it says 200 people were surrounding him, this young child, and he was crying as his legs hurt. He was feeling pain. Imam Hussein swiftly, like lightning, he gets on his horse and he goes to the battlefield, and he holds the head of Qasim in his hand, and he begins to cry as Qasim leaves this land. Sallallahu alayka ya Aba Abdullah. Sallallahu alayka ya Madlum bil Karbala. Sallallahu alayka ya Sayyid al-Shahada. السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله وعلى الأرواح التي حلت بفنائك عليك مني سلام الله أبدا ما بقيت وبقي الليل والنهار ولجعله الله آخر العهد مني لزيارتكم السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين يا حسين يا حسين يا حسين يا حسين